Thank you for listening to this podcast from TRE, Talk Radio Europe, your voice in Spain and around the world. For more information, please visit tre.radio.
The TRE Book Show is sponsored by Audible. Click on the Audible banner on the talkradioeurope.com homepage to download your free audiobook today. Terms and conditions apply.
The Book Programme. Presented by Hannah Murray.
Good evening. On tonight's book show is Miller Caldwell, who's a prolific writer and a direct descendant of the Scottish poet Robert Burns. His research for A Reluctant Spy has been conducted over the course of 26 years. Miller was moved by his great aunt's unsung courage during the war, so has created a fictionalized account of her work as a spy. Also with us is K.L. Slater, back on the book show. She's the best-selling author of psychological crime thrillers such as Safe With Me, The Mistake and The Secret. Her books have also sold nearly 130,000 in audio format. The Apartment is disturbingly based on a true story, the Little Albert experiment from the 1920s. It's about trust, control and fighting back against manipulation. It's an original Audible audiobook written especially for Audible and is narrated by actress Tuppence Middleton. And finally, back on the book show is Jane Wenham Jones, a well-known author and journalist who's published 6 novels, 3 non-fiction books and a humorous diet book. Her latest novel, The Big 5-0, is set around a group of friends who are planning a shared 50th birthday party. As with all of Jane's books, it touches on very real issues that women deal with on a daily basis. On tonight's book show on Talk Radio Europe.
The Book Programme. Presented by Hannah Murray. The Book Programme. Presented by Hannah Murray.
Joining us on the line now from the UK is Miller Caldwell, who's a prolific writer, the author of 23 books spanning fiction, non-fiction, self-help and children's literature. A direct descendant of the Scottish poet Robert Burns, he was born in Glasgow, raised in Angus and educated at Edinburgh University. In 2006, he met and challenged Osama bin Laden during a trip to Pakistan, an experience which saw him interviewed by the BBC. Diagnosed with mild cognitive impairment, Caldwell was forced to retire at 53, although his writing thankfully continues undeterred. He's with us on the book show to talk about his latest book, A Reluctant Spy, the research for which has been conducted over the course of 26 years. He was very much moved by his great aunt's unsung courage during the war. Welcome to the book show, Miller.
Yes, that's all correct.
That's good. That's a good start.
Did you receive it from Clink Street?
I did, yes. They sent me all the information, yes.
All right, yes.
Yes, it's good to have you with us on the book show. And it must be lovely to have this book out there now, considering you've been researching and looking into it all for so many years.
Ah, yes. And my agent wants it to be a documentary in Europe. ARTE, the French film company, have got it.
Oh, fantastic. And how do you think it's going to be as a documentary?
Let me put it this way. When film directors look for a book, they're all pretty flat. But if one raises up to a documentary, they'll all have a look at it. And my agent is a film agent.
So tell us about the research that you did for this book then and what happened with your aunt.
My family kept it secret. My parents kept it secret because the spy died in 1956. I actually met her in 1954 as a four-year-old, but of course knew nothing of her. The story began in 1989, which is 30 years ago, when a new game called Trivial Pursuit was produced. And I got that for Christmas for the family. And on Boxing Day, we decided to play it when my godmother came down from Glasgow with my parents. We lived in Troon in Ayrshire at the time. I'm now in Dumfries. And one of the questions was about Germany. Do you want to know what the question was?
Absolutely.
Well, the question was, which German city was a medieval city and has always been so. In other words, wasn't damaged during the war. And the answer happens to be Regensburg. But when Germany was mentioned, my 90-year-old godmother looked at the ceiling and said, "Oh, I don't want to go back to Germany." There was a hesitation, and we wondered why, because no one had mentioned she was going to Germany, especially at the age of 90. And that's when she divulged that her cousin had gone out to Germany in 1912. And she was a graduate, an arts graduate from Aberdeen University, and she went out to brush up her German, as it were. And at a concert in Hamburg, she met a man who turned out to be a GP in Hamburg. They got engaged, and their honeymoon was back in Scotland. That's where they met my godmother. And they invited her to come over to Germany in 1914, which she did in July. And, of course, the war broke out on the 4th of August, and she was trapped behind German lines. And she was smuggled out of Germany through Denmark and came back to Britain. And the story was written up by the Forest and Nairn Gazette, which I got a copy. Now, because it was written under wartime conditions, it just said that she was helped to get out of Germany. And when I asked my godmother about that, she said, "Oh, that was Hilda," because she was married to a German. And I said, "Good heavens, what happened to, during the rest of the war?" And she looked over at my parents, who looked a bit blank, and it was because she was a double agent. Now, had she been a spy for Britain, she'd be famous, and we'd be very proud of her, but she actually spied for the Nazis before Britain, and that kept pretty quiet during the 50s, well, before she died, and so it was kept quiet as a family secret and then forgotten. But it was my godmother who brought it to life again. And I heard that she had been a double spy. And when I retired, I thought I should write about this. But I had been in Ghana, West Africa, for 8 years, and I know Ghana very well. And in Ghana, there are mission stations from the Basel mission and the Bremen mission, which is German. Basel was obviously Swiss, but had some German language speakers in it. And they were pro-Nazi. This is just a novel I made out about my aunt, although I didn't have too much information at the time. That was called Operation Oboe. But I gave a copy to my uncle, who was the medical officer of health for Perthshire and Kinross. He read it, liked it, and said, "Yes, an interesting story, but that's not the true story of Hilda." And I said, "Oh, do you know it?" He says, "I know much more of it. I've even got her oboe." And in the end, I've inherited her oboe, and I learned much more about her, and the rest I found out online about her afterlife being an ambassador's wife. So he told me about how she got to Portugal and how she escaped and got back to Britain and how she met up with Mr. Simpson, Francis Simpson, who turned out to be a diplomat during the war in Belgian Congo. And when he came back to London as a widow, and she was a widow, they got engaged, but she couldn't go over to Finland, where he'd just been appointed as the British ambassador, because she had been cited to give evidence at the Nuremberg trials. It was only after that she went out. And they had two more positions, one in Tehran, which she loved, loved the people, and had a wonderful time there. And then finally Warsaw in Poland, and they then retired. She died in 1956. He died in 1961. Now, how did she become a spy? Well, the doctor husband died in 1938. She had a son who was in the Hitler Youth, and she decided to come back to Forest in the north of Scotland to visit her ailing parents. And as a result, she asked her son to stay with aunt and uncle, and the new address was picked up by the Hitler Youth and sent to the Gestapo, who visited her and forced her to reveal, when she was in Scotland and coming back to Germany, where the northern air bases were in Scotland and was the troop movement in the north of Scotland. Now, in 2014, the Times of London, for the first time, published the fact that had Hitler won the Battle of Britain, which he didn't, of course, he would have invaded Britain through the northern airports, and that was why they needed the information about as many airports in the north of Scotland. So when she got to Aberdeen, what she did was go to the police and tell them what she had been asked to do. She was detained overnight for MI5 to come up from London, and she told them exactly what she was expected to do. She didn't go back to Germany until 1939 in February, but by that time she was turned and she was told to give the following facts about the airports. One was the vast majority of them, indeed almost all of them, were farmers' fields which had been rented out to wealthy young, usually men, to fly their biplanes and gypsy moths and whatnot. Now, the implication of that is you couldn't send heavy airplanes with tanks in it. They would just get caught in the mud, Scotland being a pretty wet country, as you know. And as for troop movement, she said she didn't see any troop movements, but the word that got around that they were building defences around the Scottish coast, which of course they weren't. But the Germans took that line, hook and sinker, and they were so pleased with that. As the war was approaching to start, she was sent to Baden-Baden to do telecommunications. And at that Baden-Baden telecommunications centre, there were 12 Americans. And she was amazed. But in fact, there were actually Germans who had gone to America in 1928 to 1930 and gained American citizenship. Now, America at that time, the economy was dwindling, and they looked to the homeland, and of course the rise of Hitler, the popularity of social nationalism, and hence their allegiances fell towards the Nazis. And that's why they had come over to help the Nazi cause and learn the telecommunications skills. They were then sent out to the Eastern Seaboard of America, where they were involved in shipping companies, hotel staff, barbers, you name it. They had all sorts of jobs gaining information. And Hilda, on completion of this course, was sent to Portugal, where she was given a cottage on the coast. And that was to receive the messages from the Eastern Seaboard. Now, all these American spies of German background were known as the Duchesne Ring. And they were sending, first set of coordinates came over, which Hilda had to pass to Berlin. And Berlin made a mistake by telling her, congratulations, she had sunk the first convoy ship. She was so horrified about this that when the second set of coordinates arrived, she changed the coordinates so the U-boats wouldn't find the next convoy. But she knew she couldn't keep this up. So she feigned her death on the beach, making very elaborate arrangements, and made her way to Lisbon. Of course, Portugal wasn't in the war. She went to the British High Commission in Lisbon and said who she was. They had that confirmed by London, and she was flown the next day to Northolt by London, and she was cross-examined, and that's how these spies in America were eventually imprisoned for the duration of the war. So they realized which side she really was on. And for the rest of the war, she was had to make herself available to talk about Germany at war, what it was like over there, what the economic situation was, etc. And also to translate some technical German which came her way. Of course, she didn't really know. It was from Bletchley Park, where my mother-in-law actually worked as a decoder. She is 96 now. That's a beside. And then, of course, it links up with what I said earlier at the end of the war, meeting up with this ambassador who had been a military attaché in Hamburg when, in 1932-33, there were soirees at the embassy, not the embassy, the council offices, where Hilda played her oboe. And because before she died, she gave it to my uncle, who was bachelor at the time. And after writing Operation Oboe, he came to see me and gave me Hilda's oboe, which I still have. Wow. So basically, that's the story.
Incredible. Amazing to have all that in your family. So did you find lots of research? You mentioned that there was research online, but was there also letters and things like that that you found within the family?
Oh, yes. There was a letter from Hilda. It mentions my father and actually mentions us. She was giving her regards to Jim and his family, that being me. So she obviously knew about me. Unfortunately, it was a 3-page letter. I've only got page 2 and 3. We don't know what happened to page 1. Nevertheless, I put it in the book. There is a comment from one of the army generals who said he didn't have the forces to go to the north of Scotland. They were all concentrating on the southeast to prevent an instant invasion. So I've got that report in. Mark Horn of The Times gave me 2 pictures about Hitler's plans to invade the north of Scotland, the map they had, and also after the success of the invasion of Norway and the paratroopers, Hitler went to see them, and there's a photo taken of him there with his instant troops, as it were, to invade. So all these things are in the book.
And has it been an enjoyable experience putting it all together?
Yes.
Yes, I imagine. And what do your family think?
Well, my sister knows about it. My brother died 3 years ago. He was the youngest. He died at 60 of cancer, so he knew about it. But I can't get information from him, obviously. But my parents eventually realized they could talk about it because it's a much more open society. And, of course, lots of stories did come up out about the Second World War, and they were beginning to diminish because of the age of those involved are dying now. But, as I say, my mother's 96, and she was at Bletchley, so that's really one of the last generation.
Yes.
And so they don't think there'll be many true stories coming out of the Second World War these days.
No, absolutely. Well, it's great that you're able to tell this story. And I have to ask you before we say goodbye, a couple of things I mentioned in the introduction. Being a direct descendant of Robert Burns, that must be a wonderful thing.
I'm also the president of the Dumfries Burns Club because it celebrates on the 18th of January the 200th anniversary, and 2 Secretary of States are coming, several MPs and members of the Scottish Parliament are going to attend, and there's people from abroad and people from Aberdeen that are coming to this. It's going to be a very big event in Dumfries.
Oh, fantastic. That would be amazing. And also, I have to ask you about meeting Osama bin Laden. How did that come about?
I live in Dumfries, and I knew a policeman who was a Muslim, and he had a restaurant. And I met him in town, and he said his niece died in the earthquake. I said, I'm very sorry to hear that. He said, could you possibly go out to Pakistan to help one of the camps? I said, let me get back to you. Spoke to my wife. She said, well, if you want to, you could. So the dog had just died. That freed me up. And I did go out, and I arrived in Islamabad. Stopped twice at Heathrow and at Islamabad because in my bag was a metal object the size of a gun. It turned out to be a mouth organ, which I had to play in Islamabad. And when it was produced at Heathrow, I played it as well, proving it was a musical instrument and not a gun. It had come up rather strangely on their computers. So I got out there, and on the second day, there was a very serious meeting going on. I was invited to attend at the camp. A farmer and his wife had donated the tiered land for the tents to go up, and there were 24,500 people there in the camps. And the farmer's wife, brigadier of the Pakistani army was thinking of prosecuting her or having her prosecuted because some of the aid had gone to the village which wasn't affected by the earthquake. So I put my hand up and said, whenever there's a world disaster, the aid comes flooding out, but on ground where the disaster has been, the organization is not always ready. And this is exactly what's happened here. I have sympathy for the farmer's wife. And the brigadier stood up and pointed at me, said, you are not a Muslim. And I nodded, and I thought, what the heck's that got to do with it? He said, you are independent. I nodded, yes. He said, I'm going to make you the camp manager. So I became the camp manager. And it was a 24-hour job in a tent with a Kalashnikov. And I eventually succumbed to a sort of flu-type infection. I was absolutely exhausted, literally resolving disputes. They often took out their Kalashnikovs in the camp. When water was seeping from one tier to another, they had made the lip of mud big enough, high enough to prevent the water going through. So that was one disastrous thing I had to resolve. But the rest was about getting the food out. We got blankets, and I made the mistake by saying that's a Robertson tartan when I gave it to one of the elderly men. And he came back with all sorts of others who had already received their tartan rugs from Britain, and I had to tell them which tartan each was. I had to make up one or two, of course, from my mind, because I didn't want anyone to be disappointed. But I gave them Scottish names, but I knew quite a few of them anyway, having a kilt myself. So because I was ill, I was taken to a place in Mancera where there was an eye hospital, but underneath there was accommodation where I could be cared for, just a mattress on a concrete floor. And slowly I did recover. And just before I could go back, a car arrived in the compound, and I went out to see who it was. I was still standing a block above, and the tallest man I'd ever seen approached, and he looked so familiar. So I said, alaikum salam, tikakzapalo, and greeted him in Urdu, not that I speak a lot of it. And we hugged each other, and I had grown a beard and was dressed like a Muslim in Pakistani attire, and our cheeks met. And then he said he was looking for someone who spoke beautiful English. And I said I didn't know who that was. And he said, who are you? I said, I'm the camp manager. He said, where do you come from? I said, Scotland. At that point, he turned with his accomplice and ran as fast as he could to the car, which he got into in the back. And the car went out of the compound and turned right, which is the road to Abbottabad. When I eventually came home, I told the chief constable, I told the MP, Osama bin Laden's in Abbottabad, he's got a house there. They said, no, Miller, he's in an Afghan cave. Well, of course, time went by, and of course he wasn't in an Afghan cave. He had been since 2006, as I said, in Abbottabad, where the American SEALs killed him and buried him at sea. So there was no place to worship him. And I mentioned this to some of the Pakistanis, who said, yes, but it's an open secret. He comes to Mansera and to Mundihar to do shopping. So 4 million people in each of these towns. And they see him as a bit of a hero because he stood up to the Americans, and it was payback time. That's how they interpreted 9/11. So that's why they didn't report him.
Yes.
Anyway, that's that story.
Oh, fantastic. So many wonderful stories. It's really been great to have you with us. Do you think you're going to write more, Miller?
Well, I've written another book because I was nearly a Russian spy.
Oh, my goodness.
Will I tell you why?
Sure.
In 1967, my father being a Church of Scotland minister, the big perk was to have a four-week holiday. And we went to the island of Jura, which has one road. It's wonderful to go there for a weekend if it's sunny, but we were there for a blinking month, and I got so bored. You could see the Corryvreckan whirlpool at the top, the Paps, which are the mountains you could climb, and the other thing was the distillery. My dad being a non-drinker and my being underage, there was no way we were going to visit that. So I asked my mother for the family radio, the bush radio, and took it up a hill just behind the house. It was a sunny bank. I disturbed the first adder I ever saw and fiddled around with the dials. There was nothing in the home service, nothing in the light service that interested me. And I pressed the shortwave, got a farming program. The farming program talked about the great English breed, the Ayrshire cow, and I thought, that's a mistake. And then they talked about coal mines in Suffolk. Suffolk's as flat as a plate, and it's known as arable land and also for sheep. So there are no coal mines there. There was no punchline. Right at the end, they said, this is Radio Moscow. So with nothing to do, I wrote to Moscow and the radio station in Moscow saying there were mistakes. I thought nothing more about it and got home to find a letter from the Russian embassy, which had a nice letter saying they'd expect a package from Moscow in the near future. And indeed it arrived, and that included one of these semicircles you turn over and the snow descends on it. You know what I mean?
I think so.
Well, inside it was the Kremlin and the Red Star Square. And I also got the booklet of when they're broadcasting in Britain. I also got pens with Moscow and pencils with Moscow on it. And I also got a pen pal, a girl 2 years older who was going to write. She sent her photograph, which was fun to keep in my wallet and show my friends because she was older and she was gorgeous. But of course, I was never going to meet her. And I continued to write the occasional letter to her. And then I became a student and I received a check for £2,000 from the Russian embassy. Now, in 1969, that was a lot of money. In fact, it was too much, and I realized I was getting entrapped. So I sent it back to Moscow, and I heard nothing since. So I wasn't really a Russian spy, but I was very nearly a Russian spy. And, of course, I realize now that that's how they trick people to get in touch with them, by broadcasting, making mistakes as one of the ways.
Oh, isn't that amazing? That's
so
incredible.
I wrote Caught in a Cold War Trap, and the first two chapters are true.
Yes.
And then I turned it into a novel.
Fabulous.
Well, it'll be published in November.
Okay, that's great. Well, maybe we can get you back on when that's out. It's a fabulous story. Miller Caldwell, thank you so much for joining us. If listeners want to get a copy of your latest book, it's called A Reluctant Spy. Thank you very much for joining us, Miller.
It's lovely to speak to you too.
The TRE Book Show is sponsored by Audible. Click on the Audible banner on the talkradioeurope.com homepage to download your free audiobook today. Terms and conditions apply.
The Book Programme. Presented by Hannah Murray.
Joining us on the line now from the UK is K.L. Slater, or Kim Slater. She's the best-selling Audible Studios author of psychological thrillers, which have collectively sold nearly 130,000 in audio. Her thrillers include Safe With Me, The Mistake, and The Secret, and she's been with us on the book show before. Her latest book, which is an Audible original, is The Apartment. It's a fast-paced thriller about trust, control, and fighting back against manipulation. It is narrated by Tuppence Middleton. Welcome to the book show, Kim.
Thanks, Hannah. It's good to be back.
Oh, it's lovely to have you with us. Thanks for joining us. And this book you have written specifically for Audible, unlike your other books, which have all been released as physical books first and then come out on Audible. This is the other way round.
That's right. Yeah, it's a first for me. And it's kind of a thing that authors are starting to do now. It's a new kind of concept, really. So The Apartment is called an Audible original. So all of my, as you said, all of my psychological thrillers that I write for Bookature that are in book form, and then the audio book gets recorded from that. But this time it's an Audible original, and it's only available from Audible for a limited amount of time, and then it may be an ebook. All these audios and e's, and yeah, it's a bit confusing.
It does get confusing, yeah. So how was it for you writing a book for Audible then, instead of writing a normal book? Did it differ at all for you?
Well, partly because Audible commissioned it from me, so I knew I was writing it primarily for Audible, but that it would be possibly be an ebook later on. But what I realized when Audible asked me to do this, they approached me I think it was 2017, actually, or early 2018, when they approached me to do it, I sort of realised, and I hadn't done before, that my writing, I do kind of pay attention to sounds. I suppose that sounds a bit silly, because lots of authors do. But I tend to be quite a visual writer, and I do talk a lot about sound, how things sound in my books. So that kind of made me aware of it. And I think that when I was writing The Apartment, it made me more aware of how that would come over with a narrator, and with it being on Audible only for a while at least.
Yeah, interesting. And the story is actually based on a true story, the Little Albert experiment from the 1920s. What can you tell us about that?
Well, It's a few years ago now when I first came across, just surfing really on the net, and I came across the little Albert experiment, and it was just shocking, because in the 1920s, when this experiment came about, it was carried out by Professor John B. Watson, and it was groundbreaking, and it made him famous, and everybody thought it was amazing, and it was actually this video on it. If you Google it, there's lots of video on it, and it's really shocking for us these days, because of course it's thought of as unethical. Because a baby, he basically frightens just a small baby. He frightens him and makes him terrified of certain things, certain objects, and like a white rat. And it's really disturbing to watch now. But in the 1920s, we've got different ethics then. So now his research has been, sort of vilified, really, and is not no longer acceptable to people. But, of course, I hadn't got an idea that I'd be writing anything for Audible about that. But as often happens with ideas, is they sort of get lodged, a little seed, and then they can, as happened here, come up later on. You know, it sort of stayed in my head, and it got me thinking about how the present time is so indelibly linked to the past, and that's how the book started, really. It's difficult because I'm trying not to give any spoilers or anything, but it started with that true story, and something that I found out about it years ago. So I wasn't thinking about writing a book then, but that's how ideas work for me.
So how have you sort of adapted the true story into a fictional thriller?
Well, I've done that. Obviously, true crime and stuff like that is not crime, really, but in terms of the experiment. But true crime, so popular these days. But what I've done is, as you've said, most of the novel is fiction, is me sort of imagining a story around that experiment. And the way that I've done it, and the way that I thought about doing it, was in flashback. So I was able to research the experiment and flash back in terms of a journal and a sound recording, which worked really well for the Audible recording, a sound recording of the professor, flashback. So it still is fiction, but it's based on on facts about the experiment. And that's how I incorporated it into a modern day setting of someone going to live at a place called Adder House in Kensington.
So what can you tell us about the characters in the book? It's a lady called Freya and her daughter.
That's right. So what it is that Freya has had a bit of tragedy in her life, and things haven't gone well for her, and she's really scared about the future, and she has a chance meeting, or thinks it's a chance meeting, in Starbucks in Kensington High Street. It's one of my favourite places in London, Kensington and the High Street. So I thought, oh, I've set it there. And the great thing about it is, again, when my husband and I have walked around the streets of Kensington, you know, you've got these really imposing, enormous old houses, like mansions right on the street. That a lot of them have been converted into apartments now. But, you know, I always think about how it must have been when one family lived there, or whatever. And we walked down this particular street, and my husband took photos of a couple of the houses. And again, it wasn't, I wasn't at that time when I was looking at the houses thinking about the apartment, because I hadn't been approached for it. But immediately it came into my head that a young woman moving in there with her daughter to an apartment, to a really grand old place that had been converted, and sort of creepy scenario coming from that, that seems like a really fabulous opportunity that is too good to be true.
Yeah, definitely. So did you enjoy writing the book?
I really enjoyed writing the book, yeah. And it was sort of quite novel, thinking it was going to be on Audible. And I was writing it specifically for Audible, but with also, of course, a nod to it being a book, because I'm used to writing just regular psychological thrillers, and they translate perfectly well into Audible. So I'm hoping, you know, it will be the other way around as well. But I enjoyed playing with sound and the thought of sound, particularly in this book, and that was helped by the flashbacks and by you know, an old crackly sound recording from the past. That all translated really well to Audible, but I did enjoy it writing it, and then it was brought to life when I actually visited the Audible studios in London to see Tuppence, who was amazing, reading it. So that was fabulous. I really enjoyed that.
Yeah, I bet. It must be lovely seeing and hearing someone read it out. How important is getting that voice right, do you think?
Oh, I think it's so important. Lucy Price Lewis is the narrator that does my regular psychological thrillers, and she's got a fabulous voice too. And Tuppence was, I mean, she's just a first-class actress, and she's in the new Downton movie, and she's done all sorts of great films. And, you know, she's just so fantastic at doing the voices. And I was particularly excited when I got there and she started to read. And one of the characters that I wrote, who lives at Adder House, lives in the house that Freya and her daughter go to, her name's Audrey Marsden. And Tuppence started reading her part, and it was fabulous, because it was exactly the voice that I'd got in my head. So that was amazing. When you sort of match, you know, your voice in your head matches what the narrator thinks the character should sound like. That was a really nice experience.
Oh, so. I bet. That's brilliant. So if people want to download the book, they can just go on to Audible, can't they?
Yeah, they can go on to audible.co.uk or audible.com, and it's a credit. It's available to members only. It costs a credit if you're a member of Audible. And I think there's a sale on at the moment, which is great, because I think it's about 40% off all titles at the moment on Audible. So that's quite a good bargain. But that's where you get it from. And you can get it from Amazon, you know, because Audible is an Amazon company. You can get it on Amazon too.
Mm-hmm. And for people who haven't ventured into Audible books yet, it's a really great thing to do, isn't it? You know, if you do do a lot of walking, you know, it's a good thing to be listening to whilst you're walking, or just another way of relaxing at home or whatever. It's really fantastic.
It's absolutely amazing, and I'd encourage anybody to at least have a go. I mean, you can get a free trial for a month, and I'm an Audible member, fully paid up member, and you know, I've listened to and enjoyed, in a voracious reader, but I've enjoyed them just in the same way as reading. You do get that experience, and because I'm a writer and I sit in front of the screen all day, I love a bath at night, and I'll listen to my audio in the bath because it gives my eyes a break. And then I know a lot of people who do a lot of traveling, like on the tube, you know, they might read at home, but then they switch to their audio, and it does it automatically, or clever technology, it switches to where you are in the book, and you can listen on audio. But I love it, and I think everybody should give it a go. Some people, of course, prefer it, you know, they prefer it to reading if you take things in better by audio.
Yeah, definitely. Or long car journeys as well, it's a good
thing. Definitely. And it's surprising how you can get through a book between 7 to 10 hours, or even more, you know, if every time you go in the car, even to the supermarket and back again, if you do that regularly, it's amazing how you can get through a book.
Yeah, definitely. Well, if people want more information, Audible or Amazon, they can go to. The book is called The Apartment, and it's by K.L. Slater, who we've been chatting to today. Kim, thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks so much, Hannah. I'm coming to Spain in about a week myself, so I hope the weather's nice there.
Oh, fantastic. We'll keep it nice for you.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank
Kim.
You. Bye.
Bye-bye.
The TRE Book Show is sponsored by Audible. Click on the Audible banner on the talkradioeurope.com homepage to download your free audiobook today. Terms and conditions apply.
The Book Programme. Presented by Hannah Murray.
Joining us on the line now from the UK is Jane Wenham-Jones, who's a well-known author and journalist. She's published 6 novels, 3 non-fiction books and a humorous diet book, 100 Ways to Fight the Flab and Still Have Wine and Chocolate. Her 6th novel out now is The Big 5-0. It's set around a group of friends who are planning a shared birthday party. As with all of Jane's books, it touches on very real issues that women deal with on a daily basis, like finding love again, struggling to pay the bills, and learning to leave the past behind. Welcome to the book show, Jane.
Hello, Hannah. Well, thank you very much.
It's a pleasure. Thanks very much for joining us again. And a lovely subject, I think, in sort of general terms for a book, a group of women getting together to share their birthday party. Where did you get the idea from?
Well, I found being 50 quite a trauma, actually. I didn't quite lie in a darkened room on my own, but it was quite close. And I just sort of like the idea of looking at why big birthdays have more of an effect on us than ordinary ones. I mean, it's a nonsense, really, that you should happily go through 49 and have come to terms with it all by the time you're 51. But when you're actually, I remember, you know, 40 seemed a big deal too. It seems remarkably young now, but at the time, it seemed a big deal. So there was that. There was sort of looking at big birthdays. But there was also the fact that women of 50 are so different now from, say, even when my mother was 50 and certainly when my grandmother was 50. You know, she was a little old lady in a pinny with silver hair. And today's 50-year-olds are still grappling with all sorts of different issues. So I sort of looked at a range of women. The 4 women in the book are all at a different sort of place emotionally, practically, financially from each other, because there's so many different ways that you can hit 50, you know, in 2019.
It's fascinating, isn't it? Because years ago, people were saying, you know, 30 is the new 20, then it was 40 is the new 30, then it was 50 is the new 40, and we're still going on. I think I heard people say the other 80 is the new 70, like it just keeps going.
That's right. And today's 50-year-olds look absolutely fantastic,
yeah,
don't they?
Oh,
you know,
absolutely.
Particularly some celebrities, you know. And it's not, you know, it's not sort of, you're not old now if you're 50, whereas you would have been once. But, you know, and 50-year-olds are still sort of chasing careers, you know, building their careers still maybe, rather than looking towards retirement. As women become mothers later, they might still have teenage children rather than children who've left home and gone off on their own. And some women, of course, still haven't settled down or haven't had kids at all. So I've looked at all those different aspects.
Fascinating. So all the women in the group are in very different places in their lives.
Yes, I've got an empty nester, Charlotte, who's sort of feeling the sort of lack of her daughter. Her daughter's gone off to university. I've got a single mother who's actually really short of money still. Then I've got a successful woman who's got her own business and has got plenty of money, but actually, you know, she's sort of post-divorce and having an affair with a younger man. And then I've got a woman who's never found the right man at all, and who's sort of living with her cat. So
interesting aspects. And looking through all the different prospects of these women, has it made you kind of think which way is the right way, or is the point that there is no right way?
I think the point is that there is no right way, and that we can't make assumptions about how we're going to be at a certain age anymore. I mean, it used to be that a certain sort of trajectory, and at 50 you might have be winding down and spending a lot of time in your slippers and doing the garden, but it's not like that now. And women are having to retire later and later. So you can't, if you were 30 today, it seems to me that you can't make assumptions about what sort of 50-year-old you're going to be.
No, absolutely. There are plenty of 50-year-olds who haven't grown up yet, you know, in the nicest possible way, who are still really enjoying themselves, going out on a regular basis, doing their careers, as you say, may have young children or no children at all, single, going out dating, you know, having a great time and living like we might assume a 30-year-old would live.
Yes, and one of my characters, Sherry, she's still internet dating, still looking for that elusive Mr. Right. And she's got all those sort of preoccupations and insecurities and worries about never finding anybody that you might have once expected only very young women to have. And I think that's a very real dilemma. I know women in their 50s who have either divorced or they've never really found the right man. They've had a few relationships, but they're actually still hopeful of finding somebody that they can have the next 20 years with.
Definitely.
The other thing about my characters is that each one of them has got something going on in her life that the others don't know about. So they've all got a little dark secret going on.
Right.
And I've also chosen the dark secrets to be the sort of thing that you might be grappling with at that time in your life.
One of them, which I assume is one of the secrets, is an interesting one. One of the lead characters is moonlighting as a dominatrix.
Yes.
And you've researched, I like the way you phrase this, researched through one of your own friends who works in this area.
Yes. It was quite an eye-opener doing the research for that, actually. I mean, one of my friends was really helpful because she's done it for a number of years. And I had no idea what an appetite there was for it. I mean, she's inundated.
Really?
Inundated with men paying her very, very good money. I mean, it's not, and there's no sort of sex goes on. It is just her being terribly strict and wielding a cane or a slipper.
How weird.
Yeah, and you know, she is inundated with men paying very good money to be stood in the corner. And, you know, given a good six of the best. when I first found out about this, I mean, I knew it existed, but I didn't know the sort of the ins and outs of it all, no pun intended. And so I got her to tell me all about it. She was really, really helpful. So, you know, that whole strand of the book is based, you know, in reality. And I've had, you know, people, because it's set in my hometown of Broadstairs. It's set locally. So I've already had people who've read it saying, is this available locally? What's going on here? So, yeah.
Fascinating. So it's a standalone novel, isn't it? Do you like to do standalone novels?
It is a standalone novel, but what I have done is one of the characters, Charlotte, was one of the main characters in my novel Prime Time. So I've brought her back, and obviously, you know, when she, in Prime Time, her daughter was 13, I think, and now she's just gone off to university. So I've sort of moved her on
by years.
And there's The Wine Bar. My third novel was called One Glass Is Never Enough, and it's based on my time running a wine bar in Broadstairs, where I live in Kent. And so the Green's Wine Bar, as it was in that book, has made an appearance in my subsequent books. You know, somebody will just go for a drink there or refer to it, because I quite like that, you know, that sort of continuation. But all my books are standalone as far as the stories are concerned. Yeah,
that's nice, having the little bits that flow through them all, though, or some of them.
Yes, I love it. Three of the novels have been set in my local area, and it's really nice to write about your local area, because it's much easier. You don't realize how much time you spend thinking, oh well, where shall she live, oh, you know, how far from the station will she be, and then you've got to sort of remember that. You've got to remember which direction she goes to go to the doctors or whatever. it sounds odd, but actually the setting of the place can take quite a bit of time and detail and working out. Whereas if I set it in places I know, I can just visualise walking down the high street and watch your pass, and I know exactly how long it takes from, you know, that bar to get back to the bus stop or whatever.
Yeah, very clever.
It's quite fun.
And are they all set in modern times as well?
Yes. I mean, I tend to write, yes. So if you read my backlist, they're sort of set further away, if you know what I mean. One Glass Is Never Enough is sort of set around 2005 when I wrote it about that wine bar. But they're all set in the time that I write it. So this one is sort of based on them being 50 now. Mm.
Brilliant. Well, if people want to get a copy of The Big 5-0, it's available to buy on our website and the TRE bookshop section, and it's by Jane Wenham-Jones, who we've been chatting to. Jane, thanks very much for joining us.
Oh, thank you so much, Hannah. It's been lovely.
The Book Programme, presented by Hannah Murray.
You've been listening to a TRE production. If you've enjoyed this programme, there'll be another episode waiting for you next week, right here on this platform, where you can also access our extensive back catalogue of shows and interviews. For more information on our live programming, social media channels and apps, and how to contact Talk Radio Europe, please visit tre.radio.